So I pushed myself up and crawled over him to dig my school uniform out of the mess on the floor. When I'd finished changing clothes, I had Miles wait by the front door while I crept into the kitchen. Dad was alone, staring out the window over the kitchen sink. I tapped on the doorframe to get his attention. "Your mom's on the phone with Leanne," he said. I checked the clock. 7 in the morning. That had to be a new record for her. "I'm going to school," I said. He turned away from the sink.
"Lexi, I don't want to be here all day."
"Your mom doesn't want you to go." "Just today, please." I wasn't letting Miles go by himself, and I knew if I kept pushing, Dad would cave. "If it makes you feel better, Miles will be with me all day." He shoved his hands into his pockets.
"Actually, it does. But you know she's going to be pissed if I let you leave."
I waited. He waved a hand in defeat.
"Go, but promise me you'll come home if you get scared or panicked or if anything happens. Tell Miles this, too, so he can bring you back here."
He had to raise his voice for the last part. I was already marching to the front door. Believing something existed and then finding out it didn't was like reaching the top of the stairs and thinking there was one more step. Except when the thing was Charlie, the stairs were 5 miles high, and your foot never found the floor again. Being back in school after that kind of drop was surreal, like I was falling past everyone else so quickly they couldn't even see me. Everyone ignored us for the most part. After classes were over, Miles and I retreated to the gym and sat behind the scorer's table. He barked out orders. All hands were on deck to set up for the awards.
"Celia," Miles snapped. "Why are you late?"
Celia hurried into the gym, her lank brown hair hanging around her pallid face. "Sorry," she whimpered as she settled onto the bleachers, wiping her eyes.
"Richard, Mr. McCoy wanted to talk to me."
My heart sank. Why did he want to talk to her? What were they doing in his office? Why did McCoy have a picture of her and her father in his house? Miles scrutinized her.
"About what?"
Celia squirmed.
"Nothing."
"Celia, what did he tell you?"
"It's none of your business, douche."
A little of Celia's old self resurfaced. She huffed and went to sit at the end of the bleachers, then dropped her head into her hands and began sobbing. This was worse than usual. Much worse. I forced my breathing to remain even. If McCoy came anywhere near Miles, I'd be on him like a snake. Like that python.
"Be the snake," the little voice said. "Be the snake. Squeeze the life out of him."
Miles glanced toward the gym doors that led to the rotunda.
"McCoy will be here soon," he said.
I couldn't tell if he was worried or scared. "Do you think he's still in his office?" I asked. Miles nodded. Celia was having a breakdown. McCoy was probably sharpening his executioner's axe. If I went now, I might be able to head him off. Stop him before he ever left his office. It could work.
"I'll be right back," I told Miles.
"Restroom break. Stay away from McCoy if he comes in here, okay?"
"Okay."
As soon as I was out of Miles's sight, I began jogging. The rotunda was dotted in red. Trophies, pictures, whole pieces of wall dripped with red paint. A long, wavy red line led the way from the gym to the main office at the far end of the main hallway. I followed it.
"Be the snake."
I strode past the front desk, ignoring the protests of the secretary, and pushed my way into McCoy's office. He sat behind his desk, looking unusually put together. Suit, tie, hands folded in front of him, bloodshot eyes. The office was just an office. Certificates framed on the walls, books on a bookshelf, computer humming on the desk.
"It's okay, Mary,"
he said to the secretary. She huffed and went back to her seat. "What are you going to do?" I asked, bawling my fists at my sides. McCoy picked a piece of lint off his sleeve.
"What do you mean?"
I know you've been calling Celia down to your office for the past 4 years. I know you've been working on some kind of plan with her mother. And I know you hate Miles. I know you're trying to get rid of him because Celia's mom said he's an obstacle.
I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about, Miss Ridgemont.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. I glanced out the door to make sure the secretary wasn't listening. I'm not crazy, all right? I know about Scarlet. I know about your obsessions. I'm not letting this get past me. And I'm not going to let you hurt Miles. McCoy rearranged the nameplate on his desk.
You're mistaken. I don't plan on doing anything to Mr. Richter.
If not you, then who? Celia?
I can't say I know what Celia Hendricks has to do with it.
Look, psycho.
I realize you've had a difficult year, but are you sure you're taking your medication regularly?
I have, actually. You're not my mother, so please don't ask me that again. Now tell me what you're going to do to Miles.
Again, Miss Ridgemont, I'm not going to harm a hair on Mr. Richter's Aryan head.
He paused, and it took all my willpower not to look away from those searing eyes.
You should hurry back. It would be a shame if you failed your community service requirements right at the end of the year.
I hesitated. If McCoy revoked my community service hours, I would definitely get sent away somewhere, Woodlands or worse, and I would probably lose all class credit for this year. He had leverage. I had pieces of a story and a psychiatrist on speed dial. He laced his fingers together with a benign smile.
I think we're finally seeing eye to eye.
No, we're not, you asshole. But I couldn't say that. I couldn't say anything if I wanted to get out of here in one piece. I stood on the other side of his desk, shaking with fury.
Have a nice day, Miss Ridgemont.
I trudged back to the gym in silence. I couldn't stop McCoy on my own. But if I told anyone about this, who would believe me? It might sound vaguely believable coming from someone like Tucker, but from me? There was no way. If I even breathed a word of something this big, my mother would have me committed before I could say, "Just kidding!" I entered the gym on the other end of the bleachers near the scoreboard. The bleachers had already filled with athletes and their parents. The members of the club were stationed around the room near the doors. Miles stood beneath the scoreboard, his back to me. Celia stood beside him like she was on a leash. McCoy was already there. He was already standing at the mic in the middle of the gym. Already talking. But if he was here... But if he was here, who had I spoken to in his office?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to our annual Spring Sports Awards. We'll begin with our league-winning baseball team, who've had a great season.
My shoe squeaked against the floor. Celia turned and saw me there. She was still crying, but harder than before. Her mother was standing in the shadow of the bleachers on the opposite side of the gym, with her business suit and her long blonde hair. But her face... I had seen her face before. In the newspaper. In the display cases outside this gym. In Celia's own expression. Because when they stood side by side, the similarities were unmistakable. But Scarlet... Scarlet was dead. Scarlet had been dead for years.
"Remember, Celia,"
she said, her voice filling the gym.
"I'm doing this for you."
Celia didn't react.
"Richard and I have sorted everything out. It'll be over soon."
Celia didn't react because Celia couldn't react because Scarlet was dead.
"You can move on."
The scoreboard gave an ominous creak. Scarlet smiled. Mr. McCoy spoke a little louder at his microphone when the scoreboard creaked a second time. No one noticed. I couldn't be the only one seeing this. It was happening. It had to be. Except Scarlet. Scarlet wasn't smiling at Celia. She was smiling at me. And she lifted one pointed cherry red nail toward the scoreboard. I looked up. Red paint dripped down the wall. Each letter was 10 feet tall. The two words crunched the scoreboard between them like bloody teeth. Crimson Falls. The scoreboard screamed too loudly for McCoy to cover it up. Celia jumped away, scrambling onto the bleachers. Miles turned to hiss at her. The scoreboard's supports snapped. My feet stuttered. Scarlett's high laughter pealed across the gym. I shoved myself off the doorframe and slammed into Miles' back. Chapter 52. Here's the thing about dying in a sudden and tragic accident like getting crushed by a scoreboard. You don't expect it. I expected it. So I think that's probably why I didn't die. Chapter 53. I forced one eye open, then the other. My head had been caught in a vise. My mouth was lined with cotton. The light in the room was low, but enough for me to make out the ridge of my legs and feet underneath the covers of a bed, and the dark alcove around the corner where the door would be. A white noise machine hummed in the corner, and a sterile smell crept up on me. I was in the hospital. Bed, bathroom, machines hanging from the ceiling, red-eyed camera by the door. No hallucinations here. My body was still asleep. I flexed my fingers and toes to make sure I could, then looked around. The curtains were pulled back from my bed. The bed next to mine was empty. On the other side of me, a figure swaddled in a blanket slept soundly in a chair that looked like it had been designed by a torture expert. My mother. I coughed to clear my throat. She jerked awake, stared at me blankly until she seemed to realize I was staring back at her. Then she was right in front of me, brushing my hair back from my face.
"Oh, Alex."
Her eyes had already glazed over with tears. She held me carefully like I'd break.
"What happened?"
"That scoreboard fell on you?"
she said, sniffling.
"Don't you remember?"
"Sort of." I did. I remembered running, then pain, then the light closing off around me like I was being smashed between pages of a book.
They said they weren't sure if you were going to wake up.
A sob escaped her, and she clapped a hand over her mouth.
"Where is Miles? Is he okay?"
Yeah, honey, he's fine.
"Is he here?"
"Not right now, no."
I had to figure out where he was. I had to make sure he was safe.
"How long was I asleep?"
3 days.
"Mom?" I said it mostly from surprise. The tears were spilling down her face.
"I was so scared," she said.
"When your dad told me you went to school, I wanted to bring you home, but he said you'd be okay."
"This wasn't his fault."
"I know it wasn't."
"It wasn't my fault either."
I know.
She wiped her eyes with the collar of her shirt.
"I don't blame you. Of course I don't blame you. I just want to keep you safe, and I don't think I know how to do that anymore."
Carefully, making sure nothing hurt too badly, I propped myself up on my elbows. She took the hint and put her arms around me, hugging me to her. Why had she waited so long to tell me about Charlie? Was it because she couldn't bring herself to think about it? Or because I was happier when Charlie was around? And was this why she wanted me to go to the mental hospital? Not to get me out of her hair, but to save me from myself, because she couldn't do it anymore.
"I brought you some Yoo-hoos,"
she said when she finally pulled away, sniffing.
"I put them in the fridge because I know you like them cold."
And I thought she poisoned my food. So apparently crying did hurt. My tears stung. I felt the pulse in my head as my face heated up.
Love you, Mom, I said. She leaned over and kissed my forehead. Chapter 54. The next day, while Mom went for lunch, I got an unexpected visitor. Celia. She stood at the edge of the room, looking a little more like her old self. Blonde hair, too short skirt, layer of makeup, topped by a coat of strawberry-colored lip gloss. You know, I began, finishing off a drink of water from my sippy cup. Everyone says history repeats itself, but I did not expect it to be so literal. Her jaw tightened, her hands fisting in the hem of her shirt. Tough crowd. She stood there, staring, like I was going to whip a couple of throwing knives out from under the covers and use her for target practice. Finally, she said,
"How did you know?"
"I'm crazy. Didn't you hear?" I said. "The real question is, why didn't you tell anyone?" Celia shrugged.
I don't know. I didn't think anyone would care. They'd say I was just trying to get attention, or that it was my fault, or... I don't know.
Suddenly, she looked very, very old.
I'm tired of this. I'm tired of being alone. I'm tired of the way people look at me, and the things they say. And I'm tired of trying to deal with it on my own.
So don't, I said. You're allowed to ask for help.
Why doesn't anyone tell us that?
Because maybe no one told them?
Do you think I'm a bad person? Celia asked quietly.
No, I replied. I don't think you're crazy either. She smiled. It wasn't until a few hours later that the nurse came in and said,
"We're all so surprised you haven't had any visitors yet."
Chapter 55. The club visited later, when Mom and the nurse were in the room, so I knew they were real. They brought candy and flowers and history textbooks. You know, things they thought would cheer me up. They sat around the bed for most of the day, recounting with great detail and enthusiasm how heroic I looked knocking Miles out of the way right before the scoreboard hit him, and how everyone in the gym freaked out, and how I was still all over the news. Apparently, Miles hadn't been McCoy's target at all. The scoreboard was meant for Celia. She had moved out of the way because she thought I was attacking her. McCoy, enraged, had tried to strangle Miles and had been dragged off by Mr. Guntry. A weight lifted off my chest. McCoy had slipped up. The threat was gone. "But you're never going to believe why he tried to drop a scoreboard on her," said Evan. "You know how McCoy is always calling Celia into his office?" said Ian. "Apparently McCoy was obsessed with Celia's mom," Theo said, cutting to the chase. "And she got crushed under that thing years ago. Since he couldn't have her, he settled for Celia. But Celia wasn't living up to his standards or something, so finally he decided he'd immortalize her by dropping the same scoreboard on her that killed her mom. The cops found all sorts of incriminating stuff in his house. Journals and plans and, like, videos of Celia. When they got to the school after McCoy tried to strangle her, Celia told them everything, right in front of all of us. It was horrible." "It was so weird," Evan added.
"It was going on for 2 years, and nobody knew.
Why wouldn't you tell someone about that?"
"Maybe she didn't think she could," I said. Theo nodded. "I believe it. I talked to Stacy and Brittany after the awards. Apparently Celia's dad got remarried a few years ago, and Celia's stepmother was planning on kicking her out of the house as soon as she graduated. And her dad was on board. Stacy and Brittany said Celia hardly ever told them anything, and they were her only friends."
"She has a stepmother?" I said.
"I've only seen her a few times," Theo replied. "Short brown hair. Looks like she should be really nice, but I'm not totally surprised to know that she isn't."
Was this why Tucker and Miles hadn't questioned me all year when I said I'd seen Celia and McCoy speaking to Celia's mother? Because they thought I was talking about her stepmother?
How many more hallucinations had gotten past me because of miscommunication?
How did no one suspect McCoy before this? I asked.
He has been voted number one principal in the office 3 times, Jetta said. And his office was spotless.
Apparently he did a pretty damn good job cleaning up after himself, said Ian. If he didn't have all that stuff at his house, he probably could have said Celia was making things up. At least they still would have gotten him for trying to strangle Boss.
Theo huffed.
At least now when Celia testifies against him in court, they'll have a house full of hard evidence to back her up.
Does anyone know if she's okay? I asked.
She was molested by a psychopath for 2 years, Art said. So, no.
Only after I threatened to rip out the stitches in the side of my head did they finally tell me what Miles had done.
He went all white, said Art. I've never seen someone lose all their coloring like that. Then he screamed at me to cut the power, and he ran over and started trying to lift the scoreboard off you. We had to pull him away so he didn't electrocute himself.
They all looked suddenly guilty.
We wanted to help you, Theo said.
Mr. Guntry came back right after that, Evan said, with the paramedics and everything. They lifted it off you, but Miles was still there, and he made this noise. And Mr. Guntry made us shut him in the boys' locker room before he did something stupid like going after McCoy in front of all those cops.
Ian finished. I took a long draw from the straw jammed into my Yoo-hoo bottle, trying to calm myself.
Where is he? I haven't seen him. He knows I'm awake, right?
They shared uncertain looks.
We haven't seen him since, said Jetta. He hasn't called any of us.
We drove by his house, but his truck wasn't in the driveway.
Evan looked at Ian and Theo, who nodded.
And we checked at Meyer, but he hasn't gone into work. I thought he might be at Finnegan's, said Art. He did get banned, but I didn't think that would stop him.
So none of you have seen him since the scoreboard fell? They all shook their heads. A lead weight sunk in my stomach. The threat from McCoy might be gone, but there was another threat to Miles. One I couldn't fight. Chapter 56. My hands itched for my magic eight ball. For Charlie. For soft, dark, quiet safety. For answers to questions I couldn't answer myself. For escape from this world by retreating so far into my own head I never had to question whether it was real or not. But I couldn't stop worrying about Miles. It was Wednesday night, 6 days after the scoreboard fell, 3 days after I'd woken up, half a day before I was scheduled to leave the hospital, when Tucker burst into my room, his coat dripping with rain.
Oh, finally decided to come visit?
I put the finishing touches on my newest Crayola masterpiece, a picture of a T-Rex. It reminded me of something, but I couldn't think of exactly what.
I didn't figure it'd take you this long to show up.
Alex.
The tone caught me, made me look up again.
What?
What is it?
Miles. I think he's doing something stupid.
I threw my legs over the side of the bed and hunted for the shoes Mom had brought me.
Have you talked to him? What did he say? He hasn't been coming to school.
Tucker's words came out short and fast.
I haven't seen him until just before I came here. He was at my house. He looked really freaked out, like someone was after him. He apologized. Except he kept tripping over his words.
I stood, grabbed Tucker's hand, and pulled him toward the door.
What else?
I peeked around the doorframe.
He wanted to make sure you were okay. He said he couldn't come himself.
I ignored the invisible buzzsaws cutting holes in my stomach.
Give me your coat.
What?
Give me your coat. You're sneaking me out of here.
But you're hurt.
I don't care if I'm missing a leg, Tucker. We're going to Miles' house, and you're driving.
Give me your coat.
He did.
I pulled it on, zipping it all the way up. I balled my hair back and pulled the hood up to cover it.
Lead the way, I said.
Chapter 57. My perimeter checks were useful, but it was Tucker's knowledge of medical speak that got us out of the hospital.
I knew I'd never be able to repay him for sneaking me out. And I'd never really be able to thank him for being worried about me when he found out Miles and I were together, instead of being angry. We sprinted across the rain-soaked parking lot to Tucker's black SUV and peeled our way out to the street. He didn't ask me what I thought was going on. They used to be best friends. He probably already knew. I couldn't see Hannibal's Rest because of the dark, sheeting rain. But I knew when we passed my street because the Phoenix sat atop the stop sign, its feathers flaming red in the rain. We swerved through the Lakeview Trail entrance. Tucker pulled up in front of Miles's house. I spotted Miles's truck in the driveway, but not the Mustang that had been there before. "We have to get inside." I jumped out of the SUV.
"What?
We're going into the house. Come on." Together, we climbed the fence into the front yard. I desperately hoped Ohio wasn't out, or couldn't hear or smell us in this rain. The monster dog would tear us both to pieces. The front door of the house was shut tight and all the first-floor lights were off, but a light was on upstairs. I pulled Tucker to the doghouse, freezing when I saw the hulking silhouette of the huge Rottweiler, apparently asleep. But there was something unnatural about Ohio's stillness. Chills ran up my arms. This was it. This was the night. I climbed up on the doghouse and reached for the drainpipe, like I'd seen Miles do when he'd left the house that night. It had been reinforced with pieces of wood that stuck out at odd angles and made perfect hand and footholds. Miles must have put them there. The trick to climbing them was not combusting from the fiery soreness burning through my entire body. Within minutes, both Tucker and I were on the rain-slicked porch roof and making our way to the room with the light. The window was open enough for me to wedge my fingers underneath and pull it up. Tucker and I tumbled inside. I started out noticing the little things. The notebook spilling from the closet. The hunk of Berlin wall sitting on the dresser, crumbling on one side like part had been broken off. The words scribbled on the walls. A picture frame sat on his nightstand. The black and white picture was of a man who looked almost exactly like Miles, one eyebrow quirked up, wearing a black flight jacket, and standing next to a World War II-era fighter plane. "He's not here," I said. "We have to search the rest of the house."
"What about Cleveland?" Tucker asked.
"I think he's gone. His car is gone." Tucker didn't look so sure. "Come on!" I walked to the door and wrenched it open. A stale smell hit me straight in the face, and I realized how much Miles's room had smelled like him, like mint soap and pastries. Tucker followed me out into a narrow hallway lined with doors, all open. The rain and wind howled outside. This place was so cold, so sad. I wondered how Miles managed to live here at all. Tucker walked toward the opposite end of the hallway where a staircase descended to the first floor. A single light bulb over the stairs cast a halo on his black hair. He sucked in a breath.
"Oh, shit."
"What?"
"Oh, shit, Alex. Oh, shit."
He started down the stairs, two at a time. I ran to the top of the stairs and looked down. Miles sat against the wall at the bottom, slouched over. One second I was at the top of the stairs, and the next I was at the bottom. Tucker was already at his cell phone speaking to a 911 operator. I knelt next to Miles, wanting to touch him but afraid of what I'd feel. Blood dripped slowly onto his glasses. The extra weight pulled them down until they hung off one ear. Would he be cold? As dead and empty as the house around him? This could not be happening. I was hallucinating all of this. I could make it all go away if I tried hard enough. But I couldn't. And it was real. I placed a shaky hand over his heart. I couldn't feel anything. I pressed my ear against his chest, closed my eyes and prayed, really prayed for the first time in my life to whatever God was listening. "Don't go away, don't go away." Then I heard it.
and I felt the almost unnoticeable rise and fall motion of his chest as he breathed. Tucker dragged me back. "Is he breathing?" I asked. "Is he really breathing?"
"Yeah," Tucker said. "Yeah, he's breathing."
Chapter 58. We sat on the front steps as the paramedics took Miles out of the house on a stretcher. The cops found Cleveland's car not far away, wrapped around a tree, and Cleveland stumbling around in an angry, drunken stupor. Connections were not hard to make. Tucker took me back to the hospital. To my surprise, no one yelled at me, but I did pull a few stitches, blow up my blood pressure, and get a couple more days in the hospital under strict confinement to my room. I was okay with that, because the next morning, I got a roommate. Chapter 59.
Mr. Lobster, do you think my hair is more communist red or your red?
Morning sunlight swept across the tiled floor and over the white bedsheets, bathing the room in warmth. The white noise machine under the window dulled the beeping of the monitors next to the bed. The only other noise came from occasional footsteps in the hallway and a TV somewhere.
"Fire truck."
I hardly heard it, he said it so quietly. I wasn't even sure he was awake at first. His eyes barely opened, but he licked his lips.
"Fire truck,"
he said again, a little louder.
"Strawberry, stop sign, ladybug, Kool-Aid, tomato, tulip."
He slowly raised his arm and reached out, feeling for the bedside table.
"Glasses."
I had his glasses. They dangled off my right index finger. I gently took his hand and placed them in his palm. He fumbled with them for a moment before finally getting them straight on his face. He blinked a few times and stared at the ceiling.
"Am I dead?"
"Fortunately, no. I know you were pretty hell-bent on it, but it didn't really work out."
"What happened to the good dying young?"
he said, his voice breaking. I smiled, even though it felt like nails were being hammered into the left side of my face. "We're not good, remember?" He frowned and tried to sit up and fell back again, groaning.
"God... what happened?"
"You got beaten up and thrown down a flight of stairs. Want to explain what you were doing?"
"I don't really remember. I was upset."
"Yeah, I figured that much."
"It wasn't supposed to go that way."
I provoked him. He looked around, saw the other bed.
"You're in this room, too?"
I nodded. "Someone likes us." He carefully turned his head, wincing, to look at me.
"Your face."
I smiled again. I was wondering when he'd notice. "It's only the left side," I said. "The doctor got all the glass out. He said when the swelling and redness go down, I'll look basically the same as I used to. Just with a lot of scars." Miles frowned.
"Are you okay?"
"Great," I said. "Concussion, electrocution, scarring... nothing I can't handle, trust me. You should be more worried about yourself. I know how you like to keep people away, but after this, I think you might have your own fan club."
"What are you talking about?"
he asked, licking his lips again.
"Is there any water in here?"
I reached for the glass of water the nurse had brought earlier. As he drank, I explained what had happened to Cleveland after he'd thrown Miles down the stairs. They got him. He was pissed. I guess he thought they were going to help him or something because he told them exactly where he lived and what had happened. There was already an ambulance at your house, so they pieced it all together. I paused and curled my legs up underneath me. "Anyway, Cleveland's sitting in jail. They aren't going to hold the trial until their 3-star witnesses are ready to testify." Miles opened his mouth to say something else, but then smiled and shook his head. I searched for a word for what I was feeling, for this mix of relief and exultation and serenity, but I couldn't think of anything. Words were his thing, not mine.
A few moments later, the nurse came back to check Miles' bandages and ask him how he felt and if he needed anything.
"Well, I guess if you're feeling up to it, your friends can come on in," the nurse said.
"Who?
Did she say come in?"
Jetta poked her curly-haired head through the doorway and looked around. The rest of the club was visible over her shoulder.
"Don't be too rowdy."
The nurse edged her way out the door as the club came spilling in.
"Hey, boss."
"Mein Chef."
"You look like hell."
Miles looked at all of them, Art, Jetta, and the triplets, gathered at the foot and side of his bed, and frowned.
"What are you all doing here?"
"We're your friends,"
Theo said slowly, like she was explaining some fundamental truth to a child.
"We were worried about you."
"See?" I said. "They do like you."
"Who said anything about liking him?"
Evan asked.
"Yeah, we never said we liked you,"
said Ian, smiling.
"We just prefer that you don't die."
"Where would we be without our fearless leader?"
Theo added.
"How'd you guys get out of school?"
Miles asked.
"Skipped,"
said Art.
"Wasn't hard."
"You two are like heroes," said Theo. "The story is in every paper. Have you seen all the presents you've been getting?"
She motioned to the stacks of cards and flowers on the table by the window. They'd been arriving on an hourly basis since the story had gotten out.
"I still don't understand why they'd send gifts,"
Miles said sharply.
"It was your mom," Theo said. "She told us the story. Why you did all that stuff in school. Why you worked all the time."
"Why didn't you ever tell us?"
Ian asked, but Miles didn't seem to hear him. He was looking past Jetta toward the doorway.
"Mom."
June leaned through the door, clutching a large purse in both hands, looking like a deer in headlights. She took a few steps into the room. I wondered if this was the first time in years she'd really been outside of Woodlands. I wondered if she'd only been able to leave for Miles. We all filed out past her. I stopped outside the doorway and looked back in. June held Miles tightly, rocking back and forth. I couldn't see his face, but I could hear him laughing and crying and saying something muffled by June's shirt. A moment later, a smartly dressed woman walked past us into the room. I waited in the doorway long enough to hear her reassure them that everything would be better, and then ducked out into the hall. The triplets went down to get food while everyone else headed to the waiting room. I went with them. My parents were around somewhere, and I wanted to tell them what was going on. I didn't even have to leave the floor to find them. They sat in a small, secluded little waiting room, alone except for my doctor and the gravedigger. Their voices were strained and hard. Anxiety settled in my stomach. They hadn't seen me coming down the hallway, so I pressed my back to the wall and crept closer, positioning myself around the corner.
"I don't think we have any other option at this point."
That was the gravedigger, talking like she had any say in what happened to me.
"How could she have known that it was falling?" Mom asked.
"Unless..."
"But they said the principal loosened the supports," Dad said. "He was trying to drop it on that girl. Lexi didn't have anything to do with it. She was just reacting."
"Still..."
"Damn you, gravedigger. Shut up. Shut the fuck up."
"This incident can't have done her any good. She's unstable. I've noticed her getting worse all year."
"But we've seen her, too," Dad pushed. "Good things have happened, too. She's coping. She has friends. A boyfriend, even. I wouldn't feel right taking that away from her."
"I think Leanne may have a point, David," my mother said.
The gravedigger jumped back in again.
"In my professional opinion, this is a critical time, and she needs to be in a safe, monitored place where she can regain control. I don't mean to restrict her, and I'm glad she's added to her support structure, but that doesn't change the facts."
I couldn't listen to any more. I made my way back to my room, where the lawyer had left, but Miles and June were still smiling and laughing.
"Alex, dear, there you are,"
June motioned to me. Come and sit over here for a while. We have so much to talk about.
I'm feeling a little tired. I think I'm going to sleep for a while, I said.
You get all the rest you need.
June smiled warmly.
There will be plenty of time to talk afterward.
I pulled myself into the bed and yanked the sheets up, my face and side burning with pain. I wondered how much time I would actually have. Because as much as I hated it, and hated this, and hated her, the gravedigger was right. Chapter 60. I woke up once in the middle of the night. Bloody Miles stood at the end of the bed, blue eyes wide and piercing, blood oozing from his freckles. Holding his hand was a girl with blood-red hair and a million cuts on the side of her face, her eyes as wide as his. They stood there for a long time, staring at me. Neither of them said a word, but they both smiled with blood-stained teeth. Chapter 61. I woke later. It was still night. Miles was writing in his notebook. He looked over when I rolled onto my back and sat up.
"Feeling any better?" he asked, smiling.
"No, not really." He closed his notebook and set it on his lap.
"Come here."
I tottered to the edge of his bed, pulled my legs up next to his, and leaned my head back against his shoulder. His arm wound around me. The world was hollow. What had been the point of this year? Senior year, all the college applications. Would it have been better just to go straight to the hospital after Hill Park? I was the one who said no. I said I could do it. I said I had it under control. The only thing my parents could be accused of was trusting me too much. Miles waited patiently, pretending to be interested in brushing my hair back. "My parents are sending me to Crimson... to that hospital. I heard them talking about it."
"But you're old enough. They can't decide that for you," he said quietly. "You don't have to go if you don't want to."
Then the tears came, spilling out before I could catch them, stinging my face on their way down.
"I don't," I said. "But I think I need to. I can't tell the difference by myself. Not anymore."
I don't know if he understood anything I said through my blubbering, but his arm tightened around me and he kissed the side of my forehead. He didn't say anything. Didn't try to persuade me otherwise. He'd escaped the tank. I didn't know if I ever would. Chapter 62. Later, when I'd calmed down, Miles leaned over the side of the bed and grabbed his backpack. He unzipped it and took out a few things. "Can I look in your notebook?" I asked. He quirked his eyebrow.
"What for?"
"Just because." He handed it over. Most of this notebook was in German, but there were still bits and pieces in English. June's name was scattered through the pages. "Why'd you keep your mom's maiden name?" I asked.
"How'd you know?"
"When Tucker and I were looking up Scarlet in the library, June was mentioned in an article. She was the valedictorian."
"Oh, yeah. We switched to her name when we went to Germany."
"Ah." He didn't need to give more explanation than that. I flipped through a few more pages of his notebook and said, "I have a confession. I've read this."
"What? When?"
When Erwin died and he gave me a ride home, you went in the building to turn in those papers and I peeked.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
he asked, but he didn't swipe the notebook away from me. I shrugged. Pain spiked my collarbone. "Well, obviously, I didn't want you to know that I looked. You didn't exactly seem like the most forgiving person." I flipped through a few more pages.
"What are these German parts?"
"Journal entries," he said.
"I didn't want other people to read them."
"Well, good job,"
I said. I did see my name a few times in that other notebook, though.
Yeah, he said, laughing again. Yeah, I was a little upset on the first day of school. I didn't think you were the right person. It was stupid, but I guess I didn't think it was you at first because you didn't act at all like I'd imagined you would.
Ha, sorry. I thought that about you, too. I turned to the last pages. What you loved as a child, you will love forever. I think you're an improvement on my imagination, I said, flipping back through the pages.
You too, he said. My imagination, well, what little imagination I have doesn't quite live up to the real thing.
Agreed, I said. The real thing is much better. Chapter 63. I got to come back one more time. Maybe they thought I'd gotten all the crazy out of my system for now. Maybe they pitied me. Maybe I actually had more sway than I thought since I'd agreed to go to Woodlands. Whatever the reason, they let me into the school for graduation. There were a few stipulations, of course. The first, I wasn't allowed into the ceremony, but I got to stand by the auditorium doors and watch. The second, I had to have a pair of Woodlands orderlies, read thugs in scrubs, flanking me at all times. Sure, they were driving me up to Woodlands as soon as the ceremony was over, but did they have to look so menacing while they did it? The third was the worst. Because of the McCoy ordeal and the school board looking to avoid any further mishaps, I wasn't allowed out of the car without wrist restraints. At least they'd agreed to let me wear a sweatshirt to partially cover up the cuffs. The only reason I was going to the damn hospital was because I'd decided to. You'd think they'd be a little more lenient. By the time we reached the auditorium, everyone else was already seated. Parents and other relatives took up the right and left sides of the auditorium stage. I noticed June because of the golden halo in her sandy hair. My classmates sat in the middle section. They all wore East Shoal graduation green. The stage was bathed in bright light. It was Mr. Gunthrie who filled Mr. McCoy's vacated principal's seat. His gray suit made him look like a golem. I could definitely believe Mr. Gunthrie was animated by magic. Next to him were the four senior student officers, most of them fidgeting. Tucker sat next to the class treasurer, glasses flashing in the light, wringing his speech mercilessly between his hands. Miles was there, the valedictorian's golden cord slung over his shoulders. His hands were clasped in his lap, his eyes focused somewhere around the edge of the stage. Mr. Gunthrie started the ceremony with his usual thunderous yell. The lights dimmed until I could no longer distinguish individual people in the auditorium. The class president stood and gave his speech. The vice president said a few short words. The band played the school song. And then Mr. Gunthrie began announcing names. The honors students went up first. I had to grind my teeth to keep from laughing when Miles shook Mr. Gunthrie's hand. Even from where I stood, I could see the Cheshire Cat grin that spread across Miles's face, and the stony frown Mr. Gunthrie gave him in return. When my name should have been called, I rocked forward onto the balls of my feet, my insides aching. I'd worked so hard for that diploma. One of the orderlies grabbed my sweatshirt hood and gently tugged me back. I grunted, sitting back on my heels, and stood still while the rest of my classmates graduated. Evan and Ian pretended to get their diplomas mixed up, then tried to shake Mr. Gunthrie's hand at the same time. Theo looked like she was ready to go and pull the both of them off stage. Art made Mr. Gunthrie look like a large pebble when they stood next to each other. Then everyone took their seats, except for Mr. Gunthrie.
"Before we end the ceremony, there are a few more parting words. The first are from your salutatorian, Tucker Beaumont."
A round of lukewarm applause ran through the theater. Tucker, face red, moved to stand at the podium. I felt a rush of pride. Mr. Soggy Potato Salad, who'd decided to break into McCoy's house, jumped into the brawl at Finnegan's, and helped bring Miles home, who'd forgiven me for everything I'd done, and then some. I don't know if I deserved a friend like him, but I was glad I had him. He spent a moment adjusting the microphone and smoothing his twisted speech. Then he cleared his throat and looked around at everyone.
"I guess I'll start with a bit of a cliché," he said. "We made it."
The auditorium erupted with shouts of excitement and victory. Tucker smiled.
"Okay, now that that's out of the way, I think we can all safely say that this was the craziest year of school any of us has ever experienced."
He glanced back at Miles, who only quirked an eyebrow.
"Even if you weren't there every moment you heard about it, you were still a part of it. You still survived it. And really, if you can survive pythons coming out of the woodwork, you can survive almost anything."
Laughter. Tucker repositioned his glasses and took a deep breath.
"People say teenagers think they're immortal, and I agree with that. But I think there's a difference between thinking you're immortal and knowing you can survive. Thinking you're immortal leads to arrogance, thinking you deserve the best. Surviving means having the worst thrown at you and being able to continue on despite that. It means striving for what you want most, even when it seems out of your reach, even when everything is working against you. And then, after you've survived, you get over it, and you live."
Tucker took another deep breath and leaned against the podium, looking around at everyone. He smiled.
"We're survivors. So now let's live."
The auditorium erupted again, and Tucker could barely hide his grin as he walked back to his seat, twirling his silver salutatorian tassels. I couldn't help but smile, too. Survivors. What better word for people who made it out of this place alive? Mr. Guthrie waited for the applause and cheering to die down and then said,
"Ladies and gentlemen, your valedictorian, Miles Richter."
The sudden silence in the auditorium was even more pronounced because of the deafening noise that had preceded it. No one clapped. I couldn't tell if it was because they were scared, angry, or surprised. Miles stood and looked around much like Tucker had, but he didn't fidget while he did it. His fingers rapped against the wooden top of the podium. Tap, 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 tap. Mr. Guthrie cleared his throat loudly, but Miles was silent. Then Miles looked toward where I stood in the doorway. He smiled.
"I know that most of you don't want to hear anything I have to say," he began, "and I know the rest of you really do. And I also know that these two things mean that all of you are listening attentively. That's exactly what I want. James Baldwin said, the most dangerous creation of any society is the man who has nothing to lose."
Miles sighed and swept the graduation cap off his head. He glared at it for a moment, then threw it to the side of the stage. Behind him, Mr. Guthrie's face turned a mottled hue of purple.
"I always thought those things looked ridiculous,"
Miles grumbled into the microphone. A few hesitant chuckles came from the crowd, like they weren't sure if he was joking or not. Then he said,
"For a long time I had nothing to lose. I was that dangerous creation. I know that most of you probably think I'm a jerk."
He glanced at me again.
"You're right. I am. Not the kind that vandalizes cars and kills pets, but I am an arrogant, pretentious jerk. I do think I'm better than all of you, because I'm smarter. I'm smarter, and I'm more determined to do what I set out to do."
I wasn't sure what guidelines Miles had been given for his speech, but if the shade of Mr. Guthrie's face was anything to go by, he had wildly ignored them.
"I used to think all of that anyway," he continued. "I still do, kind of. I'm learning to, not to change, because in all honesty I like the way I am. Not what I do, but who I am.
No, I'm learning to... keep it bottled up, displace it, control my frustration. Whatever it is, it's working. I don't feel like that dangerous creation anymore. I no longer have any motivation to do the things I did here. For anyone I've wronged, I'm sorry. Whatever I did, and for whatever reason I did it, I'm sorry. Mina Muta, I pictured Cliff squirming in his seat, always taught me that apologizing is the polite thing to do. I could imagine the radiant smile stretching across June's face. I want to say a few more things. The first is to our wonderful salutatorian. He turned and addressed Tucker. I didn't mean what I said to you. You were my best friend and I screwed that up. You deserved better. The second is to the East Shoal High School Recreational Athletic Support Club. I think if it hadn't been for you, I would have killed myself a long time ago. We were probably the only ones who realized how serious he was. The third is to all of you. I used to be scared of you. It's true. I used to care what you thought, and I used to care that you might try to hurt me. Well, not anymore. So, to the latter, see how far you get in a fist fight. And to the former, try this on for size. I'm in love with Alexandra Ridgemont. And I don't care what you think about it. He looked up at me again, and the world solidified under my feet. I feel like there's something else, but I can't quite remember. His fingers tapped against the podium. He shrugged and began to walk back to his seat. Then he clapped his hands together with an, "Oh, right," and whipped back around, yanking the microphone to his face in time to say, "Ficht euch!" From somewhere in the middle of the sea of students, Jetta's hands shot into the air and she cried out a triumphant, "Mein Chef!" I couldn't tell why everyone else began cheering, the realization that what Miles had said was probably very vulgar, but their voices shook the floor. Mr. Gunthrie stood, probably to haul Miles off the stage, but Miles slipped away at the last second and made his way down the aisle. My orderlies pulled me back into the hallway. I heard the auditorium door swing open again, but we were outside, standing in the crisp night air before Miles caught up with us.
"Wait!
I just want to talk to him," I said, glancing over my shoulder at Miles. "Please? I won't try anything." The orderlies looked at each other, then at me.
"2 minutes," one of them said. "We have to leave before everyone else gets out here."
"Fine, got it." They let go of my arms. I turned and jogged the short distance back to Miles.
"I didn't think they'd let you come back," he said.
"I'm very persuasive." He laughed, but the sound was hollow.
"I've taught you well."
"Are you kidding? If I did things the way you do them, I would have been locked up a long time ago." Miles didn't say anything to that, but reached up to touch my face, the raw, still mutilated side of my face. I grabbed his hand. "When did you get so touchy-feely?" I asked. He wasn't listening. He stared at the soft cuffs, at the metal clasp that jangled between them. "They're a precaution," I said before he could ask. "I had to wear them so I could come here. Apparently the school was feeling sentimental enough to let me back, but not sentimental enough to risk a lawsuit."
"I don't like this," he said.
"Yeah, well, join the club."
"When are you going?"
"Tonight. Right now, actually. It was supposed to be this morning, but since the school agreed to let me come here, they pushed it back." His frown deepened. "It's not like I have anything to wait for."
"Fine. I'll come visit you tomorrow."
At Woodlands?" His eyebrows shot up.
"What, did you think you were going to get rid of me that easily? You should know by now. I've got the tenacity of a cockroach."
I blinked at him. "Surely you've got better things to do." He shrugged.
"I've got a few pretty good ideas, but they can wait."
"We need to go,"
one of the orderlies called. I waved my hands to show I